I think if you go into any environment and ask for a baseline against which to tune, it's really rare that you get something back and you get something that's accurate back. Often the first time that the ops teams even understand what's happening in the environment is when we apply more operational detections, user logged in, very simple things like that, that then we find out, oh, this is a broken script or here's bad misbehavior, all of which, by the way, are wins from the detection side, even though it's not necessarily a security incident.
This is the Detection at Scale podcast, a new show designed to help security practitioners succeed at managing and responding to threats at a modern cloud scale. As the volume of data increases and the attack surface expands, it's never been more important to stay ahead of the curve. Each episode will feature interviews with leading security practitioners, thought leaders, and company founders who are building the next generation of security tools. I'm your host, Jack Naglieri, founder and CEO of Panther Labs. Now, let's get into today's show.
Welcome back to another episode of the Detection at Scale podcast, season two. My name is Jack. Today, I'm here with Matt Velaitis from SAP. He is the Director of Threat Detections and Operational Strategy. Matt, how are you doing?
Really well, Jack. Thanks for having me here. I appreciate it.
Of course. Tell us a little bit about yourself, just as a quick intro.
Yeah, sure. So I started my professional career as a Linux and Unix administrator, did some Oracle database administration, and then moved full-time into SendMail, running a SendMail cluster as a SendMail admin. That was for a small startup that WebEx had purchased, and I was there when Cisco purchased WebEx. So used that as an opportunity to transition into the WebEx security team and ultimately into the Cisco CSERT, where I spent a bit of over a decade doing investigative work. The SOC at that point was very much ingrained with the investigation. So it was detect and respond, both as an investigator, the managed investigation team, and then needed a bit of a break. So I went over to Splunk to do some field sales, which was really interesting. Came back to Talos to do some threat research. And now I'm here at SAP, predominantly doing threat detection, but my team supports a lot of the SOC and the incident response capabilities as well.
Very cool. Before we jump into a lot of the security banter, I always love asking quick questions about the people on the podcast. So tell me about a personal goal that you're working towards right now, and it doesn't need to be professional related.
Personal goal I'm working towards. I have been out with a bit of a back injury now for maybe the last, I'd say, 8 months. Went over the handlebars on a mountain bike and been recuperating since. So my goal is to get fit and to get back on the bike, back on the tennis court, back active. So I'm working really hard to try and get back in shape.
Health is wealth, my friend.
Indeed.
Sorry about the accident. The back injuries are really challenging. You use your back for a lot of things, it turns out.
Yeah, it seems like that never happened when I was young, but maybe it's a product of getting older.
Yeah, that happens. The person that I follow for longevity and things like that is called the knees over toes guy. And he has a lot of like back related things. I don't know if you've seen his stuff, but for those listening, I'm a huge fan of that guy. I've done a lot of his movements for a while. He's like back and knee and like a lot of these things as we age tend to sort of become problematic. It helps a lot.
Indeed. Good investment in your health.
Of course. Personal goal I'm working towards right now, just to share and reciprocate, is I'm working towards Duolingo goal for this year. Trying to get to the intermediate level in Duolingo, which has been pretty fun. So I'm doing Spanish, been doing it for a while now. My partner is Mexican, so I do it to communicate with her family and just become more ingrained in that culture. So it's been really fun.
Very cool.
All right, let's talk about security stuff. So before we hit record, we were talking a little bit about detection theory and just kind of the techniques that we use there for finding like really interesting styles or identifiers of a potential attack. I'm always really curious just in terms of like what works most for people right now, like what's the most reliable style of detection that we're seeing, if it's like a correlation or it's like a type of threat intelligence that seems to be really reliable. Tell me a little bit about where you try to prioritize your efforts in detection that have like the biggest bang for buck.
Sure. So we're aligned. We try to take a threat-informed approach, leveraging attack, right? Like a lot of people do. So trying to find different techniques that are applicable to us and then diving into that to understand, all right, what technology is going to give us the best visibility or technologies. And then from there, making sure that that's configured per our requirements and that we can use that to identify whatever that indicator is or whatever that tactic is. So I think that's kind of the base that we start at to build up a corpus of those type of rather static rules. And then once we have enough of those built up in the catalog, then you can move on to things like risk-based alerting to make the correlation of those rules a little bit more manageable in mass than single atomic events, but really starting with those kind of basic, trying to find that activity and figuring out what works in the environment. And I say that because we spend so much time trying to make sense of detections within the specific environments. You can imagine SAP, Cisco in my background, they're very large mergers and acquisition companies. And so you end up having quite a diversified set of customers that you have to deal with, both in terms of the people, both in terms of the data, the technology. And so figuring out how one detection applies within that environment, I think at scale tends to be a big time sink.
How do you typically go about doing that? Like, how do you manage the difference in logic across the different environments usually?
So our ideas or our approach is to try and keep as singular of a detection as we can at the top. And then as we push that detection into different environments, we want the ability to make that detection specific to that environment for that to exist only within the environment. So the way that we do it now is with a macro attached to essentially a master search. And then that macro is defined within each of the environments itself. So we can do environment specific tuning based on just on that macro. Of course, that scales mostly, and sometimes we have to create unique detections for the environments, but that really lets us have one catalog of detections that applies uniquely to each environment.
What are examples of the types of macros you would attach? Like, you don't have to give specifics away, obviously, but I'm curious, like, what are the styles of things that are in those macros usually?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you a simple example. Let's say we have a pen test that's happening, and it's a known pen test, meaning that whoever's performing it or coordinating it announces to us that this is going to happen at this time. It's going to be from this set of IP ranges. Maybe it's going to involve this user. Those are all pretty specific attributes that we can attach to the query to either filter it out or maybe not filter it out, but to identify that specifically, because there's, of course, value in identifying pen test activity too. But that'll be something that we apply only to the environment that we know that's getting tested so that we can not affect any of the environments.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So in that particular case, it's more of like a suppression versus like modifying the detection logic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we see a lot of the having to do suppressions under specific circumstances for new environments that we go into. The tuning curve is very front loaded. And so that initial engagement with those lines of businesses that have the domain expertise for that environment, we find we have to do a significant amount of upfront tuning to get those exclusions in place so that it's a bit less pain on the SOC.
What type of automation are you using, if any, for doing things like this with exclusions? Because I've always been so sad that it's such a manual process.
Well, automation for exclusions. So there's definitely opportunities where if, say, that the requester of the test, they can submit that information in a form and we can ostensibly let out and attach that. A lot of the tunings that we do, though, within the environments themselves are reactive more so. I think if you go into any environment and ask for a baseline against which to tune, it's really rare that you get something back and you get something that's accurate back. Often the first time that the ops teams even understand what's happening in the environment is when we apply more operational detections, user logged in, very simple things like that, that then we find out, oh, this is a broken script or here's bad misbehavior, all of which, by the way, are wins from the detection side, even though it's not necessarily a security incident.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's just really hard to predict behaviors. And I think this is always the thing in security we always try to figure out. It's like, well, ML model can I put on it that will explain human behavior? And I'm like, I don't think there's a model. Like, it's always a guessing game. That's why it's called investigation, right? Like, it's not so much a binary, like there's an answer. It's more of, do we have enough confidence that we think we know the right thing?
Yeah, very much. And I think we were chatting a little bit earlier about the risk-based approach.
Yeah.
That's a really nice way. You're not quite getting to a baseline, but you're putting a little bit more scrutiny on the type of atomic alerts and looking at them as a whole. So that can kind of help bridge the gap between the two to say, only alert if these X things have happened. And especially if you can implement an order to those as well, you don't have to quite get to the baseline, but you can start making a bunch more sense of what you're seeing.
Yeah. I mean, even in the risk-based world, the way you're just thinking about it, where you're correlating activity in some type of order, you can kind of do really simplistic scoring based on that. You can be like, okay, if this thing sequentially adds up above a threshold, then alert me. And I don't know, it's certainly more reliable than the atomics for sure.
Yeah.
I just wonder what this world could look like in a more intelligent sort of AI way, like using buzzwords, obviously, in the first 5 minutes of our podcast. But seriously, like the progress that we've had with Gen AI has been so interesting. And I always feel like there's something in here that we could probably do with more interesting modeling of the atomics.
Have you seen the Atlas, the MITRE Atlas, trying to sequence some stuff? I think that'll be a maturation of that.
No, tell us about it. What is that?
I mean, I just saw it this morning, but what it looks like is just that. It looks like, if I understand it correctly, it's a sequence of techniques that you would see in an attack progression. So whereas the matrix, the attack matrix of itself, doesn't necessarily have that concept of a timeline, I think this is meant to introduce that. At least that's my understanding.
Super interesting. Yeah. More of like a TTP from start to finish.
Yeah, exactly. And so then if you say, okay, well, these X number of things have to happen in order for me to be alerted. And if you could then these X number of things have to happen in a certain order, you have a lot more contextualization already just by firing the alert or looking at it that way than you would by having individual alerts fire and trying to group that with your case management system.
Yeah, it's super interesting. That's really cool. So when you think about your program at a high level, what are you tracking like month over month, week over week to really check in on the health? Like, what are you reporting up? What are you reporting into your team? Tell us a little bit about those metrics.
Sure. I don't think we're doing anything out of the ordinary. We're doing our time to detect, of course, which I know your thoughts on that. And I actually tend to agree with how difficult it can be as a detection engineering team or a threat detection org to sway that number, since you're so dependent upon the pipeline and the frequency of running alerts and all these sorts of things. But time to detect is certainly one, and we have a goal for that. We look at how we're covered against. I mentioned we use a threat-informed approach to what it is that we do to build detections. So we look at how well are we satisfying whatever our objective was to say, we're going to go after lateral movement this quarter. We're going to go after initial access this quarter. We want to see how well we've got coverage on that. So a bit of a gap assessment. And then we also look more internally at the efficacy of the alerts. And I think when this works really well, when you're just entering the environments and you can immediately see, okay, this is not a true positive, it's not a false positive, it's an admin doing something that maybe they shouldn't do. I mentioned earlier, that's still a win from the detection side, if you can shape that narrative to then drive change within the environment to make sure that that behavior is, there's a better solution for it. That's something that we can put forth in front of our leaders as saying, yeah, it's not security, but it kind of looks like it. And we also improve the environment. So we try to leverage non-security things that we see as well as wins within our portfolio too.
Super interesting. For doing the threat-informed approach, is there a particular tool or something you're using for that? Is it just kind of a manual spreadsheet approach? I'm always curious how people like operationalize that.
Yeah, I'd have to defer to our CTI organization who produces the output that we then base our detection sprints on and create the sprints. But we've worked with them to say, hey, this is what we need to be actionable. We need this type, it's got to be something that we can find in a log. So just saying some actor does log and abuse doesn't really do anything for us. We need something that we can actually turn into a query of sorts. So our CTI team will prep that based on the threats that they know that are relevant to our organization or that are relevant to the industry, topical threats that might come up, vulnerabilities, that sort of thing. And then they'll put that as an input into our org. I'll also say we do a lot on our own. You know, we take things like Red Canary's threat report or these other threat reports, blog posts, and we can pull actionable information out of that and turn into detection rules. So it's really any input that gives us something actionable that we can look at, we can turn that into a detection.
Very cool. Are there other open source resources that you'd recommend folks listening in to check out for things like threat intelligence or OSINT that you think is high quality?
I mean, I think I hesitate on open source threat intel feeds to comment on that, but the MITRE ATT&CK framework works really well. We've aligned to the NIST framework and some of the controls from there actually, I think, help our detection program ensure that we're operating in a justifiable way. The Sigma rule sets are quite nice. We rely pretty heavily on pulling information from there as well. I'm sure there's other open source models that I'm forgetting about.
And then going back to what you were saying before about the threat-informed approach, you said CTI. I want to make sure we're all on the same page on acronyms.
Cyber Threat Intelligence.
Cool. Just wanted to make sure.
Understandable, yeah.
We love acronyms in security. I think just in tech in general, we love acronyms.
Very much so. Yeah,
apologies. EI, LLMs, fun times.
Hey, Detection at Scale listeners. Heading to RSA this year? Join us Wednesday, May 8th at 3 p.m. at Yokai for an in-person interview with Corey Quinn, Chief Cloud Economist at the Duckbill Group. You know Corey as the voice behind Screaming in the Cloud and AWS Morning Brief podcasts, not to mention the mastermind of Last Week in AWS. Come meet us in person at Yokai on May 8th at 3 p.m. Visit panther.com for more details.
Well, cool. I think it's really interesting when you do DNR in a large company that has a lot of different diverse footprints across the world, and talking about the idea of like layering, I always find it super fascinating. And then sort of following that sequence, most people take a detection as code approach. So I'm curious on just your experience in using detection as code, any best practices you want to share and how it relates to scaling your team out and scaling your environments and all these other things that come with running a program for multiple years.
Yeah, I think it's not really a new paradigm shift anymore, but the shift from searches to this detections code, I'm a big proponent of it. I think it does a number of things. It gives us a whole pool of additional people that we can bring in to help us build this sort of infrastructure. Having developers on the team now is something different than, say, 10 years ago. That was more of a niche thing. I'm a big fan of structure to the approach, and this detection by code does just that on a really nice level across your whole pipe. I also really like the CI/CD aspect of this, where you can do testing, unit testing, regression testing every time you make a change. I think when you start building a catalog of detections where you've got hundreds of things going on, you've got a federated model like we do, where you've got so many different environments that are unique and all those tunings that we talked about on those. Anytime you make a change, it can feel like a house of cards. So having all of this built in where I can suggest a change, I can approve the change, I can test it, and not only on that, but also regressively on all the other stuff. I think that's light years ahead of where we were 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. What type of languages are you usually using with detection as code? Because there's a wide variety.
Yeah, the detection templates are stored in just YAML formats. We've got all our standard tools of Git, nothing out of the ordinary, but structures in YAML is what we store our content as.
Nice, very nice.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on detection as code, things that you've read, learned recently, et cetera?
How it applies in our environment with this federated model. We have a lot of customers. Cisco had a lot of customers. Chuck at Sony was talking about a lot of their internal customers. You had him on the podcast recently. And so I think in this environment, you've got two things. You've got the central group that's trying to do the best for the overall company. And then you have your specific environments. There are specific environments in mind. That's their purview. And so if you can set up something where it's easy for them to contribute, they can do as much as they can, check it in, and you can do this approval from a central standpoint. That really helps getting contributions from these organizations, but also just keeping them as a player. I think there's a lot of non-technical aspects that make the merger and acquisition seem challenging. When you have some shadow groups or groups that had a responsibility and now they see this central one, we want to let them feel and encourage them to continue operating, and it's their domain expertise that we need. So the more that they can participate with what we have and not learn this nuanced custom detection environment and just operate with standard coding tools, I think that lowers the barrier of entry for contribution.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So I've been really curious just in general on what we're seeing in Gen AI with detection and response. Kind of curious, like, what ideas you read about recently or heard about recently that feel like really promising to you?
So I haven't seen it yet, but I've read about this idea of the investigative response and how that kind of conversational, okay, well, do I see this activity anywhere else? Where else did this user go to? All these things seem really ripe for me to pipe back into some Gen AI that can then go off and answer it for you. I think, again, it lowers that bar of entry for the analyst. Conversely, I think there's also some benefit in understanding how to get at that information and how you link this graph together without having a tool do it for you. But getting people up to speed quickly, less skilled people that can participate, I think that's all really good. So I'm really looking forward to that aspect of it coming into products.
Yeah. Something you said that's really important is understanding the answer is super, super important, because a lot of the times we're accountable to sometimes law enforcement around answering those questions. So whatever system we end up using has to be able to route that back.
Well, and not even law enforcement. Let's say I'm taking a host offline and it's a revenue generating P1 host. I want to make sure that the evidence that I'm basing my mitigation on is sound. And if I take that off and we have customer outages, I can't point to an LLM as saying, well, that told me to turn it off. So I do wonder how much it'll definitely help you on the initial, but there's still validation that will have to happen.
Yeah, I think it will help a lot on patterns and just sort of understanding certain things. Like, for example, I was playing around with feeding an LLM things like user agents. And I said, here's the statistical breakdown of all the user agents I've had in the last month in Slack. Tell me what it means. And it was like, well, this user agent actually means the Slack iOS app. So 60% of Jack's activity is on his Slack iOS app, which is true, right? Like, I use Slack on iOS a lot. So for things like that, it's super helpful. And looking at other patterns of behavior, like, hey, this is not very prevalent in the data set that you've put into the LLM or like you've asked about, and then being conversational with the questions is just super valuable. So I agree, it'll certainly make the barrier to entry for analysts much easier. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, same here.
Another thing I've been thinking a lot about is just data centralization. And I imagine this has been a really big challenge with a lot of the companies that you've been in as well. Cisco, obviously a massive company, SAP, a really big company. So tell me a little bit about how you've approached data collection and centralization with a security context and how you sort of partnered with your organization, like organizational counterparts, to make that happen.
Yeah, certainly. And I'll say that when I was first introduced to this at Cisco, I was not a believer in it. I have since become quite a believer in the service-based approach to really any security operation, any cost center activity. And what I mean by that is we run it as if we were running an MSP. And so we have a set of requirements of what we need people to do if they want to participate in the service. We try to provide them with a receipt at the end of the day that says, hey, you gave us this. This is what you got in return. So we really try to treat it as if it was a customer service relationship. And that has helped us justify the spend that we're taking in, justify the cross charges that we might make against them. So approaching it with that mindset from the outset has been quite helpful. If you do it from that mindset as well, then you're less concerned about forcing your constituents into a specific mold. And in environments like Cisco and SAP, where there's so many lines of businesses or business units that may be operating with some of their own controls or technologies, that allows you to be flexible. And so then what we do is focus less on the specific technology that's generating the telemetry, and we focus on how is that configured. And this gets into the strategy part or the operational enablement outside of detection engineering, but we do a significant amount of work to try and get the tools in our environment configured in a way that we need them to be. And so we've defined requirements for EDR, for web apps, for DNS. So very technology agnostic layers of the stack that then, regardless of what technology is in place, we can say, okay, we needed to do these things. And maybe more importantly, is if the solution that they have deployed cannot do what we need it to do, we can then show further on down the line, as a result of this configuration being missing, we're unable to apply these sorts of detections. So it kind of covers us all the way and it fronts the requirements so that we can get what we know we need in place early on. And that's really it. And so that way we can take data from any sort of technology that's doing the same thing, whether it's Umbrella or Bind, try to put it into the same sort of data model so we can access it in the same way and then build singular detections on that.
Yeah. So the approach is partner with the teams to pull the data into a place that you control, but you take the service-based approach where you say, we're going to put it here, our DNR, and we're going to give you access to it so you can use it for operations. Is that accurate?
Exactly. And we'll give them some carrots too, right? So we'll say, you may have your production environment, which is your expertise, that's your domain knowledge, but we're responsible for the laptops that you're running, the corporate endpoints. We'll protect the central security services. You protect your specific environments, but do it through our centralized platform. So if, say, another line of business or BU has a similar application or component in the stack, they can then reuse it. And it also gives us a way to have one central view of everything that's happening. So that way we can focus on the stuff that scales across the organization and the lines of businesses can focus on the things that are within their realm of expertise.
That's super interesting. Do you ever get requests from folks who want to do some more interesting processing of the data with direct access to the data?
Yes. We don't want to prevent people from having access to their own data. So when you talk about endpoint telemetry on the corporate environment, this gets a little bit more murky. Access to their own Apache data from their own production environment, that's easy, right? But when we're talking about mixed environments, it starts getting a little bit tricky. But in general, we try to provide their data back to them. So not only are we the central alerting platform, but we're also the central logging platform that they can access the same data from. And of course, there's always requests for unique ways of accessing the data, requests for unique ways of looking at the data, or maybe specific compliance requirements that they might have. Or even ideally, what I would love to see is an application owner coming to us and saying, hey, we know that this vulnerability exists. We're working on it. In the meantime, here's how you can identify it. That's not something that the central team would necessarily ever know about by themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you get the verticalized knowledge,
exactly,
like the specialized knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. And also I mentioned the acquisition has this mental aspect to it as well. That is trying to tell these lines of businesses that, look, there is a supreme amount of value that you provide. We need this, right? It's not there's a redundancy. It's we need what you have.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Have you dabbled in any of the open metadata formats at all, like Iceberg or Hoodie or Delta or anything like that?
I have not, no.
Yeah, it's super interesting. There's a big buzz about Iceberg right now in particular, just because it's getting a lot of traction across a lot of different data stores and databases. So it's just meant to be like this open table format that can be loaded from multiple places. So that's something that I've been seeing and paying a lot of attention to.
Interesting.
Yeah, cool. So I have a question that's a little bit more around leadership and the team and things like that. And I think folks who listen in could probably relate to this if you've worked in security for a long time, which is around the stress of running a security team or being in a security team. So I'm kind of curious, like as a leader, what types of cultural elements do you do to help protect your team's mental health? And can you talk a little bit about that? And maybe this is a current team or prior team or something when you were doing SOC related work, but always curious to hear people's tips here.
Yeah, absolutely. And my style of leadership is very much of a servant leadership style. So I exist for the betterment of my team. And I really try to operate under that ethos. In that way, I'd be very much concerned about the health of my team. If they're not healthy, then in any way, physically or mentally, then the output is going to suffer. So I think some of it goes back to just making sure that the team is a fully functioning team that likes to work together. And so making the right hires is super important. Having the folks participate in the hiring process as well, I think that's really important. So getting the right team in place is step number one. You can have the most challenging environment, the most challenging company, but if at least the people you work with are reasonable and you like it, I think it can make a significant difference. There's just the nature of this environment, especially on the incident response side, where you're going to work some strange hours, even in a follow the sun SOC IR model, you're just going to do it. And so I think as a leader, it's really important to recognize when that's happening, to acknowledge it in the act, but then deal with it afterwards. Comp time, making sure people use their PTO. If they don't use their PTO and they lose it, again, dealing with that as a leader, if you can, on the New Year's, there's all these things just to show that, hey, look, I'm looking out for your well-being, and that's important to me. I think it's making that readily apparent and acting on it is super key. There's also a lot of I think every organization that I've worked at now has had an employee assistance program, an EAP program, and I recommend that to everybody in these environments that it's really stressful. It just provides another tool you can leverage to talk to someone, find out what's going on, just to talk it through. And I think that's really, really helpful.
Love it. Great advice. Awesome, Matt. Last question I have. So you wrote a book, Crafting the InfoSec Playbook, and it talks about security and incident response and things like that. So to end the show today, I was hoping you could just drop some actionable lessons from the book that we can take away today.
Yeah, sure. So I guess, first of all, I would encourage anyone to do that. It was such an incredible experience to do that. And my two co-authors are both, they're brilliant. So I would say if you've got any inkling to do that, just take that step. We grew that off of a number of blog posts that sort of warm ourselves up, make sure that it would be well received and that the three of us could work together. So I would say go for it. That's the sort of first piece of advice. The second piece of advice from the book, I'm looking right now at our close codes for how we do incidents. And I'm finding that, what did we write that book about 10 years ago? Still applicable the way that we're looking at it. Don't overcomplicate it. You know, we have, is it a true positive? Is it a false positive? Can you not determine what it is? And is it benign, right? Like, is it a fallen scanner that we detected? Keep it simple. We're going back to that. I was referencing the book just in the last couple of weeks to point to that as well. And then lastly, I think I espouse the virtues of the service-based approach. We espouse the virtues of the service-based approach in that book as well. And I would definitely recommend people lean into that. I think it's just a really good way of thinking. I think it also helps you understand how businesses operate in general. We're in such a cost center. We're always never have enough money. We always have to justify what we're doing. That kind of flips it on its head a little bit. And I think it gives you a good way of talking about what you do in not of a, we're preventing loss, but in a we're delivering value kind of way.
Awesome. Love the insights, Matt. It was great having you in the show. Really appreciate the time. Really appreciate all the amazing conversation that we had today, and hope to keep in touch and talk to you soon.
Right on, Jack. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all. Thanks for listening. Catch you on the next episode. See ya.
Thank you for listening to the Detection at Scale podcast brought to you by Panther Labs. For access to the latest episodes, please visit our website at www.runpanther.io/podcast. And for those interested in running Panther, head to our website, runpanther.io, to sign up for a free trial. You'll get a dedicated instance with the ability to analyze your security logs in real time at any scale powered by Detections as Code and sending into a very robust security data lake. Our goal is to make detection and response easy, scalable, and fast for you, the practitioner. Thanks. See you again next time.